This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Want to Matter. Your life is too short and too precious to waste. Written and narrated by New York Times bestseller Kathy Lee Gifford. Available now everywhere you get audiobooks.
America is many things to many people. Many things to many people. To mother and her family, it's church on Sunday morning. It's all races, creeds, and religions. Church on Sunday morning. Church on Sunday morning. It's all races, creeds, and religions. Church on Sunday morning.
Greetings and welcome to the next episode of White Nation Under God. We are tackling this concept, this ideology that we are labeling white Christian nationalism. We want to talk about what it is, what it looks like, why it's a threat, and what we can do about it. In this episode, I am honored. You've got a double dose of wisdom and expertise about white Christian nationalism. I am talking to Dr. Philip Gorski and Dr. Samuel Perry. Welcome, gentlemen, to White Nation Under God.
Great to be here with you, Jamar.
It's a pleasure.
Listen, I'm just glad we were able to get both of you together at the same time. And the reason why we're doing it is because of your latest book, The Flag and the Cross. Full disclosure, y'all, I had the honor of writing the foreword to this. And they even, y'all were very generous to give me cover credit on here. I appreciate that. I was immediately gripped by the data in this book because in a very concise volume, you give us a very thorough introduction to not only what white Christian nationalism is, but specifically its threat to democracy. So we're going to start where we always start every episode. Have each of you respond when somebody asks you for the millionth time, what is white Christian nationalism? And I ask this of all of our guests because there's always a little bit of different nuance. How do you respond? How do you define or describe white Christian nationalism? Dr. Gorski, would you lead us off?
Well, I guess the way I usually define it is as a deep story, by which I mean a mythological version of American history. And it's a pretty simple story. It goes basically like this. America was founded as a Christian nation. It was founded by Orthodox Christians. It's based on biblical principles. It was given, blessed with power and prosperity to carry out a special mission. And that mission is to spread freedom and civilization and capitalism around the world. But the blessings and the mission are both threatened by the presence of non-whites, non-Christians, non-native-born folks in America. I say it's a mythological version just because it's a half-truth. It's not all wrong, but it's definitely not right either.
As a historian, I find this deep story, as you describe it, very ahistorical or selectively historical, if you want to put it that way. Dr. Perry, I was immediately struck by this idea of a deep story, that it's a narrative. And most of the time when I ask people, what is white Christian nationalism? It's, you know, one or two sentence definition that they give. Why did you feel like this describing it as a story was helpful, or what did it add to understanding this concept?
Well, I think people want to see themselves as characters in this narrative. And so especially white Americans center themselves in the story as about them, as us, our kind of people. I mean, you can hear this in the language of white Christian nationalism that's usually veiled. It's America as we know it. Our way of life is under attack. What do you mean? You know, what you mean is you mean our place in this narrative, the story that is about us and our future together is being challenged by outsiders, by religious others, by ethno-racial others, by economic others. By national, you know, outsiders from outside of the immigrants or Muslims. And so using this metaphor of a narrative or a deep story. I think it helps us understand how vital that kind of self-identification as what it means to be truly American as the protagonists in this story, and how that feels violated by the enemy.
I often use, you know, parts of various definitions, but I think as I talk about white Christian nationalism, y'all have helped me describe it as a story, which I think is a little more tangible. People can wrap their heads around that a little bit better. We talk about and we describe white Christian nationalism, and even describing it as a deep story is helpful, but how would you say it shows up? Like, what are some cultural artifacts or symbols? Like, people see that or read that, they know this is a sign of white Christian nationalism, kind of in everyday life.
Well, I think one way that you see it is like symbolism that sort of kind of juxtaposes or puts together the flag and the cross, which is where we get the title for our book. So probably a lot of folks who are listening to this have seen stand for the flag, kneel for the cross, you know, those bumper stickers that became some t-shirts that became so popular, you know, after, you know, the protests that Colin Kaepernick unleashed in the NFL and, you know, the counter protests against them, right? So it's like symbolism that just blends together Christianity and patriotism as if Christianity and Americanism, as if they were really one and the same thing. And of course, as comes out pretty clearly in the occasion for those protests, it also marks Christianity and Americanism as white, right? Mm-hmm. So is it an accident that the person who is at the center of that counter protest is you know, one of the first black quarterbacks in the NFL? I don't think so.
Precisely. Would you add anything to that, Dr. Perry?
Yeah, I think the power of this story is that for such a long time it has been left unspoken.
Yeah.
And it is buried within the everyday interactions of people in pews and in the conversations that we have and the assumptions that are made about who we are as a people. And by we, I mean, say, white Christians in a church. There's a great book by Lydia Bean called The Politics of Evangelical Identity. It's an ethnography. And she does this great work where she shows that, like, you know, most of the time, these Christian nationalist messages are not coming from people up front in the pulpit. They're just taking place in the everyday conversations as people in the pews imply that what a real Christian is somebody who shares our values and our political identity and our ideological identity. And so that's what makes it so insidious is it's the kind of thing where if you actually have to say it out loud, it is almost a vulnerability, right? Like, you want to keep it hidden. You want to keep it assumed that the real Christians, the real Americans, are people who share everything about what we share.
Oh. That reminds me of when this first started to come on my radar. I didn't have that phraseology yet, but I remember I was walking out of church one Sunday in Jackson, Mississippi. This is an intentionally multiracial church. I was walking out of church, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was some local referendum, some local policy initiative, and there was a Republican stance on it and a Democratic stance on it, and somebody had a bumper sticker in support of the Republican stance. And I remember walking by that bumper sticker with this group of friends after church, and I said, you know what? Hundreds of people are going to walk by that bumper sticker and not bat an eye. But if it was in support of the Democratic position, they would have to pull you aside and grab you by the lapels and say, hey, brother, let me tell you about the gospel. Because clearly, you don't understand Christianity if you're supporting this other side of it. So that was just this like everyday, subtle, implicit way of saying who's in, who's out, who's us, who's them, what do we stand for, and what are they about? Now,
Jamar, I think you're forgetting the 11th and 12th commandments, which are thou shalt not wear a mask and thou shalt open carry, right?
Y'all are getting
that's what I mean, you know, it's like these things that have nothing to do with the gospel whatsoever are, of course, you know, founded on biblical principles of some kind or
precisely.
Other.
And, oh, man, you're just jogging my memory. So, number one, There was a white deacon in our church and his son who were in the military. I don't know how this came about. I want to say they volunteered to do it. They started acting as security for the church. Nothing specific had happened, but they started acting as security for the church with open carry pistols on their at church on Sunday morning. I didn't have this language or this framework, but I'm like, I mean, I get the need for safety, but this feels icky. And then secondly, when you were talking about thou shalt not wear a mask, our church, when I moved back to the Delta, we actually had a church split over whether or not to wear masks. And it was the seed that ultimately led to us dissolving the congregation. But it was that, like, somebody said, and she was the wife of a physician. She said, you can wear a mask if you want, but I shouldn't be forced to wear a mask. So there's a ton to unpack here, especially in its political dimensions. But I want to get to know you both a little bit better. When I was doing my dissertation, somebody told me all scholarship is biographical. In other words, what we study, it typically has some intersection in our personal lives. And I'm wondering, what put white Christian nationalism on each of your radars as a subject of study, something that you thought was important enough to devote so much time and attention to? Dr. Perry, how did you get in on this?
Yeah, so I mean, I absolutely affirm research being me-search and autobiographical in a really a profound way. So raised in an evangelical family, graduated from an evangelical seminary, was raised in an interracial family. And so those three things of race and religion and in some ways politics have always found an intersection. They were just dinner table conversation for us growing up around the house. And so I've always been fascinated. Actually, it's one of the things that led me to become a sociologist. I've always been fascinated with American Christianity and the various cultural accretions that pile upon it and shape it and change it to where things like region and race and politics are become not only the filters but maybe even the drivers through which we interpret our own theological experiences and traditions. And so I think it was a few years ago that we stumbled upon, you know, Christian nationalism as this thing that we started to notice in the late, you know, maybe 2014, 2015. Andrew Whitehead and I were writing about this. Then also Phil Gorski's work. We had read his historical work in American Covenant, and it was just like, yes, this is exactly what we're looking at. And so this has been, I think, over the last few years, tied together a lot of the things that have been a part of my own life's journey of race, religion, and the American experience.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Dr. Gorski, how does this get on your radar?
Definitely is a biographical piece for me, too. So I spent my adolescence from middle school through high school graduation in Wheaton, Illinois, like a quarter mile away from Wheaton College and the Billy Graham Center. There are evangelicals and Pentecostals, you know, in all branches of my family. We mostly attended a kind of a mainstream Lutheran church, but, you know, would occasionally go to a Calvary temple as well. And I knew plenty of people who were members of Wheaton College Church or one of the local Assembly of God's congregations. And, you know, it was just sort of always there, always around me. And, you know, I guess part of what happened, too, was just, you know, seeing, you know, certain things that just seemed common sense to me when I was younger, you know, especially then spending some time living outside the United States. And, you know, my wife is German and she would be like scratching her head, like, well, you know, what's Christian about that? Or, you know, why do Americans believe this? And so, you know, that just gave me a certain kind of cultural distance and turned some things that had just, you know, surfaced some things that I hadn't really thought very hard about. So I guess that's kind of how I backed into the subject biographically.
Well, I'm glad the two of you linked up and wrote this book together. In it, you introduce the interaction of three different concepts: freedom, order, and violence. And you sort of frame, help us understand how this ideology is framed around these components. Can you talk about what white Christian nationalists mean by freedom, order, and violence. Dr. Perry, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think this emerges out of white Christian Americans' understanding of themselves at the center of this story. And their own part in this story is as valuing, they really do believe this. I mean, valuing liberty, valuing religious liberty. That is the religious freedom language is something that is a core part of this identity. But it's a very particular kind of religious liberty. You know, it's as we have seen recently in Supreme Court cases and arguments and about what religious liberty means. It doesn't mean religious liberty in an abstract sense or in the sense that everybody's freedom is protected. It means freedom in a Massachusetts Bay Colony kind of sense. It is our liberty to arrange a society as we believe God wants us to arrange it. And those who are not a part of that can either leave or they can change or they can suffer the violence. And so like the idea of freedom is white Christian American men primarily have the freedom. They're at the center of the story, and theirs is the nation. It rightfully belongs to them. It was founded by people like them, and it is made for people like them. And they have the freedom to establish order. That means the society as they believe it ought to work and run, namely privileging their own values and preferences. And those who violate that, either insiders who dissent or outsiders who have come to change the hierarchy are met with violence, and it's justified violence. That is, I think, a common thing. Like we demonstrate this in chapter three of the book, that white Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalism are very supportive of authoritarian means of social control, that the police are justified in using any means necessary to control problem populations, that the biggest problem with the death penalty is we don't use it often enough, and that the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Why? Well, we found this recently. This is subsequently to the book. We found in recent data, we asked Americans, we just gave them a list of the Bill of Rights, and we said, what's the most important right? And you would think that white Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalism would say, well, freedom of religion, right? It's actually the right to bear arms. It's the Second Amendment.
Wow.
Completely consistent with how we understand this. It is the freedom to exercise violence, to be able to control your own destiny in this story. And I think freedom, order, and violence is what we call the Holy Trinity of white Christian nationalism for that very reason.
It quite differs from the biblical idea of the Trinity, but is. Yeah. I think explanatory. Dr. Gorski, would you have anything to add to that idea of freedom, order, and violence in white Christian nationalism?
Well, I'll say this. I think that this Holy Trinity and deep story helps you to explain a lot of things about our contemporary politics. I'll give you two examples. One is the reaction to the 1619 Project. Why was there such a backlash against that, right? And there's sort of two reasons for it. It's like, first of all, it says, is it just white people who built this country? And the other thing about it is, you know, white Christian nationalism kind of grandfathers every white person in as somehow being there with the founders. You know, so the idea that, you know, the descendants of generational African Americans were there before a lot of white Americans, you know, in that sense are sort of closer to the roots of the country, that's just deeply offensive because you want to be grandfathered in, you want to be at the center of the story. Other illustration we use in the book is we just sort of look at, okay, we line up kind of three events of the last 15 years or so, right? Which is the Tea Party movement that emerges after Barack Obama is elected, the Black Lives Matter protests, a failed coup attempt on January 6th. So just sort of think about how conservative white Christians react to those. So the Tea Party, well, that's all about liberty, right? Freedom. I mean, you know, we know it's also about a black man in the White House, but, you know, that's not the stated reason for the backlash. Then Black Lives Matter comes along. Well, is that about freedom? No. I mean, that's all about disorder. That's about threats to property. That's about threats to hierarchy. So, of course, you know, you've got to have righteous violence. You know, if you can't get in the National Guard, if the police won't do their job, we'll send in some white vigilantes like Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, who gets celebrated. I mean, last I heard, he's signed up. He's like some lobbyist or spokesperson now for some gun rights group. You know, he's like a hero. And then look at the Capitol insurrection. What was that about? Was that violence? No, definitely not. That was peaceful, patriotic Americans standing up for their freedom. So, you know, it's freedom for me, but not for thee. You know, it was violence for me against you, all in the name of an order that puts me on the top. That's how it works.
Again, this concept has such explanatory power. This is one of the reasons I gravitated towards studying it, is we see these things and there's a dissonance. Like, well, if you're Christian, why would you support those kinds of things? But when you sort of unpack this concept, this ideology, this deep story of white Christian nationalism, it begins to have its own internal logic. We may disagree with it. I hope we do. But you see how it actually makes sense internally. One of the things that I've noticed is whenever I sort of talk about white Christian nationalism, there's always someone who chimes in and says, well, that's not actual Christianity. we actually addressed that in some other episodes. What the flip side of that is, there's a less focus on the part of folks like that on the last part, the nationalism part. Which gets at the threat to democracy. And that's one of the things that I think we really need to hone in on, is how white Christian nationalism is actually undermining the peaceful transfer of power in our nation. So, Dr. Perry, how would you explain to someone that white Christian nationalism isn't just sort of a, you know, perversion of biblical Christianity or just religious in nature, but it is a threat actually to democracy itself in our country?
Yeah, it's a threat in several different ways. Of course, the underlying ideology behind it, and this is the political theology of white Christian nationalism, is incompatible with the idea that we are all equal citizens and that we all deserve equal access, equal protection under the law, that we all should be able to be represented in our own views. We find, and we talk about this in the book, but we've subsequently found it elsewhere in other studies, that Christian nationalist ideology is quite strongly associated with believing that we already make it too easy to vote, that they would support hypothetical civics tests in order to vote. I mean, real Jim Crow stuff, like they would revoke criminal offenders for life, certain criminal offenders, that voter suppression is a lie, that voter fraud is rampant, all of these things that we would think. And that is predictable, right? Like it's the idea that only a worthy few should be able to access the vote, to be able to pull the levers of power. We found in a subsequent survey, I think last year in the summer, where we just asked Americans, is voting a right or is it a privilege? And thankfully, most Americans identify correctly, voting is a right. But the more you affirm Christian nationalism, the more you believe that voting is not a right or a privilege. In other words, it is not something that shall not be infringed, but it is something that we can take away or we can curtail. So that ideology is corrosive to the idea that we live in a society where people have a voice and they have the right to have that protected. But we also find, though, I think there's another factor to this, and that is Christian nationalism is fundamentally about us versus them. And we are the ones who are the righteous, the worthy. And to cooperate with them is an unacceptable compromise. God is on our side; they are on the side of Satan and his minions. And so, how can you participate democratically with a group? How can you compromise? How can you work and do the things that all democracies or constitutional republics require us to do, which is try to make the best out of conflicting interests? We found that this is data that we just collected a couple of months ago, but we found that, you know, of course, Christian nationalism seems to lead Americans to believe that, you know, it is not better that we say find a way to overcome our differences to solve common problems, but it's more important that we overcome our opponents to defeat them. And again, that seems like a fundamentally anti-democratic line of thinking. If we're actually going to cooperate in any way, it's us versus them. It's never us together.
And a sort of by any means necessary kind of real politic embedded within that. I would say. I keep telling people, you know, this feels like the civil rights movement of our day. And one of the pieces that I point to is that literally voting rights are under attack. What people were marching for and boycotting for 50, 60 years ago is back on the table as questionable. And I really appreciate in the chapter you referenced, you quote Mike Huckabee saying, "I don't want everyone to vote. I want the people who will vote for me and the people who understand the Constitution. And it's not great that everybody has access to the vote." Like, and he's a minister, you know. So there is a threat to democracy. It took on acute form on January 6th, 2021. Dr. Gorski, in your view, what did that attempted insurrection represent for white Christian nationalism? Was it a turning point in some sense? Did it reveal something new? What does it symbolize or indicate for us on a broader level beyond that single day?
Well, it's interesting, you know, that the insurrection happened while Sam and I were finishing up the book, actually. I mean, we opened the book with the discussion of it, but, you know, it was a moment where we really felt sadly vindicated in our analysis, because we looked out at the symbolism there out on the Capitol, and it looked like a sort of a weird jumble. You know, you had the wooden cross and the wooden gallows. You had the Confederate flags and the American flags. You had the Jesus Saves banners, and you had the sort of neo-Nazi regalia. And you're thinking, you know, what does any of this have to do with each other, right? But, you know, you kind of see it, the whiteness, the Christianity, the nationalism were definitely all on display. And, I mean, I think it was the sort of upside of it is that I think it made many more Americans aware of it, both people inside the church and people outside the church more aware of it. I think a lot of secular progressives were just completely unaware of this. It's not part of their milieu. It's not part of their subculture. The opposite was the case, I think, with a lot of conservative white Christians. It's just like so much part of the water they swim in and the air that they breathe that was basically invisible. And so I think that's been the positive side of it. Of course, you know, the negative side of it is that it is increasingly becoming a label that some people are willing to embrace, and it is becoming a strategy that some politicians are willing to use. So, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and a bunch of others have like openly embraced the label, and you know, you've got, you know, some far right, you know, basically white supremacist types who are now kind of using it as a fig leaf, you know, because after all, now, even today, it's sort of easier in polite company to say, I'm defending Christian civilization than it is to say, I'm defending the white race. Though oftentimes for these folks, there's not much daylight between those two things.
Ooh, that's like a gut punch of truth. You know, you could almost interchange, I'm defending white America as I'm defending Christian America in the sort of sociological and cultural sense. So as we're looking at the landscape, and as I listen to this rhetoric, it does strike me that folks look at the Constitution almost as a divinely inspired document. And they'll speak of it in sort of this almost the same reverent tones that they would the Bible. And I think even what theologians would call a hermeneutic, just your sort of interpretive principle, they almost apply the same kind of hermeneutic to the Constitution as they do the Bible. This, I think they call it originalist interpretation. You know, you can't mess with what the founders said or the original document, which is mind-boggling as somebody who went to seminary and got a history degree. Dr. Craig, I wonder if you could speak to that, how white Christian nationalists are viewing the Constitution.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And I think I like that you paralleled it with the Bible, because I think it is not just the Bible or the text per se or the Constitution per se that they but it is their interpretation of that of those documents, both those documents, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there are certain parts of the Bible that they minimize or obscure or sweep to the side about justice, about you know, all being one under Christ and that kind of, you know, generosity and tolerance and basically everything about Jesus's life that is not spelling money changers from the. So the same thing with the Constitution, right? Like the parts of the Constitution that they idealize and venerate would be things like gun rights. And they say, this is sacred. This is inviolable. These are rights. These are inalienable. You can't change them. You can't take them away. And a certain reading of the First Amendment, that especially the free exercise clause about, you know, my religious liberty shall not be infringed. And they minimize other parts, like about, you know, parts about no religious tests for public office or that that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Or it is an interpretation of that because, hey, when they said Congress shall make no law, you know, respecting, they assumed it was all Christians. They assumed it was all Christianity and all these states had, you know, state religions. And so, you know, it was about keeping the state out of religion. It wasn't about keeping our Christianity from influencing all of these kinds of state things. And so we definitely find the more Americans subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more they venerate the Constitution. But it's important to nuance that and say that, you know, it is a particular reading because I'm not ready to give up the Constitution to them. I'm not ready to say like, hey, let's, you know, you guys got the Constitution, we'll go something else. Like, no, actually, we feel like religious liberty is constitutional and equality is constitutional with the amendments, assuming, you know, like that with important amendments. It is we have moved towards a society that we would like to see actualized. And so, I think venerating the originalist interpretation often just means as we understand that interpretation to be.
And of course, we've got Supreme Court justices who are subscribing to that interpretation, which is leading to some decisions that are making a lot of people very uncomfortable. Let's put it that way.
And I think that's a great point, Jamar. Is you know, the strategy of all of this belies the shrinking numbers of the group, right? Like, and so if white Christian America understands that it's demographically it's on the decline, which indicators suggest that it is they're losing the population, even people who subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology might be shrinking to some degree, but because they have maneuvered successfully in order to get certain actors in positions of power, their influence can reach far beyond the actual numbers. And this is actually one of those anti-democratic things where it's like you can actually subvert the will of the majority for a long, long time, as long as you have lifelong appointments, as long as you have laws in place that will give your group an advantage from here on out.
I would just piggyback on that real quickly and just say, you know, some people look at this and they say, wow, one party minority rule for a generation or two, that would just be this incredible break with American history. Like, have you ever studied the Jim Crow South?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, and I think that's what we're potentially confronting, and, you know, hopefully something that we can head off. But we shouldn't see this as something that's like, you know, some break with American history. Is the return of a dark chapter in American history is what it potentially is.
I really appreciate you saying that, because in Mississippi, where I went to the school at the University of Mississippi for a long, long time, there was one party comprised of white people that was in power, which is why in 1964 they had to form the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to challenge the all-white delegation from Mississippi and try to break this very long tradition of one small group of people dictating standards and policies for an entire and much more diverse group of people. We've been talking about white Christian nationalists, and one of the points that we're making in this series, it's not a binary, you are or you aren't. Rather, it's, you know, a sort of whole spectrum of beliefs. And I'm wondering, from a data science perspective, what were the kind of questions or indicators of white Christian nationalism, as we speak about, you know, those who subscribe more strongly to it, what were some indicators that one ascribes to white Christian nationalism, Dr. Perry?
Yeah. So I think the measures have adjusted over time as we've sought to use better ones. I think originally when we first started to try to get our minds around what is this thing, we were using earlier data that somebody had collected in the mid 2000s that asked a series of questions that we felt like were fairly effective, things about how much Americans agreed with statements like the federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation. That's a pretty explicit one, right? I would say somebody who strongly agrees with that, you know, is pretty on board with the idea of Christian nationalism. Other ideas get more at the deep story, like the success of the United States is part of God's plan. We have since introduced new questions to ask, say, about like whether they believe the Constitution or the Declaration were divinely inspired. We've asked questions about whether or not Americans affirm the separation of church and state. In other words, they don't want a separation of church and state. They want those two things to be coterminous or together as much as possible. So I think the degree to which certain Americans would affirm explicit indicators that America should always be this Christian nation, we should formally declare ourselves that. It's not just about Christian values, but it's about formalizing this relationship, making it such. But also the degree to which Americans, like Phil was talking about, the degree to which they buy into this deep story, this mythological narrative that America has been and should always be in this special relationship with God, that he America is where God pays attention, and we you know, and he has our best interests in mind versus every other nation. I think that is that combination of beliefs helps us understand. And like you said, I mean, I appreciate that you said that. Until recently, when we've actually started asking about whether Americans actually identify as Christian nationalists, we have only asked them how much they agree with certain ideas. And so it is on a spectrum of, you know, rejecting it somewhere in the middle and wholeheartedly, like true believers, embracing it.
That's really helpful. Dr. Gorski, I'm going to hit you with sort of a current events question. So this, as we record this, Elon Musk has just taken over Twitter. And the topic of conversation that, depending on what end of the spectrum you're on, you're either really excited about or you're absolutely dreading, is the topic of free speech. We talked about the white Christian nationalism version of freedom of religion and how they interpret that. Can you speak to how someone who strongly adheres to white Christian nationalism is understanding the concept of free speech?
Well, I think what it really boils down to at this point is I should be free to use degrading language about people of other races, religions, genders, and I shouldn't face any consequences for that. I mean, not only should I not face any legal consequences for that, but I shouldn't face any social consequences for that. You know, everybody has to respect my right to say really ugly things and really disrespectful things about other people, just like in the good old days. I think that really is what, for a lot of folks, what it means.
Absolutely. Dr. Perry, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things we also find, I'll just add an addendum to that. When we asked Americans about their views on, like, what are the most important rights, it was telling that as somebody as white Americans in particular subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more important they see gun rights, the more important they see, no surprise, states' rights, the more important they see, say, religious liberty. But two things went down noticeably, and that was free speech and freedom of the press, because it is again this kind of idea that what is most important? Is it most important that people without a voice be able to speak, or the press be able to kind of tell the truth? No, it's more important for us to be able to defend our own kind of position. And so when they say free speech, they mean free, as exactly like Phil said, free speech to be able to say ugly things, speak in discriminatory language against outgroups, potentially threatening violence without consequence. But they do not mean people being able to say, talk about, political or religious views that they disagree with. That is not on offer. It's not about freedom, you know, free speech to give a talk about some kind of opposing political view. It means we feel like we're the minority and we need to be protected from cancel culture or whatever they would call it.
I mean, seems like a contradiction, right? You know, so like, how can you be against free speech but also against cancel culture? Well, freedom for me, but not for thee, right? That's one of these central principles of of this dogma, you know. Or if I could just sort of riff a little bit on Stephen Colbert, you remember his book, I'm America and So Can You. I am America and no, you can't. I mean, that's that's the message.
Very good. Our one of our philosophers of the day, absolutely, Stephen Colbert. It's this idea of freedom from consequences, you know, to say the most bellicose things and say, hey, I'm free to say it. You can't cancel me or whatever it might be. And it's got a lot of folks like Black folks and women and queer and trans people very, very nervous that, you know, one of our largest social media platforms, that seems to be the direction it's trending. And your explanation helps us understand why that would be of concern. Going back a little bit to the threat to democracy in the political sphere, I found it really interesting. You have a pretty lengthy discussion in the book, not just about republicanism or democratic parties, but about the idea of libertarianism. Dr. Perry, could you unpack what libertarianism is as a sort of political philosophy, and particularly why people who gravitate toward white Christian nationalism would gravitate toward ideas of libertarianism?
Right. I think this goes along with the Holy Trinity idea of freedom, order, and violence. It is the epitome of this liberty in every sense. Liberty and not moral liberty. I mean, they're very much into the idea of a social order, a moral order that fits with their own traditions and customs. But the idea of complete economic freedom, over and against what they perceive to be the ultimate enemy, which is leftism or socialism. We found in the book that Christian nationalism, yes, they are opposed to atheists and Muslims because those are religious outgroups, but who they really hate are socialists, because socialist represents everything. It's a catch-all term. It's one of these, like, it's a dog whistle, right? It means cultural atheism. It means failed economic policies. It also means, you know, radical minority identity politics. So much that Dinesh D'Souza, you know, had to coin a term. He called it identity socialism to say that it's socialism, but Black Lives Matter is socialism, but it's a way that's identity socialism. It's a different kind of, like, social control that, you know, to try to associate Black Lives Matter and Antifa with these with socialism, which is this demonized concept. Compare that to how the kind of world that white Christian nationalists would like to see, where they have absolute freedom to say ugly things, to spread misinformation, which is another part of the equation, is like the freedom to be able to sow falsehoods about election fraud, about COVID, about any group that they don't like, but also economic freedom to be able to maximize their own interests. We found that, say, during COVID, with a good example of this, is Christian nationalists were just not only powerfully for, you know, or against, excuse me, like vaccines or masks or any kind of lockdowns, but it was about maximizing their own prosperity, the economy, protect the economy, protect our own freedom, protect our own liberty to be able to go to church or to go to do these things unmasked, which was actually kind of, you know, funny story. We just came out with a study, not funny, I guess this is actually tragic. I should amend that. But we found that, you know, we had this longitudinal data and we found that Americans who deliberately violated the protocols and went to church when they weren't supposed to, when everybody had shelter in place order, they were several times more likely to actually, by the next survey, come down with COVID or be infected with COVID. But we found that the people who were actually most likely to be infected were the people who didn't normally attend church. In other words, they were attending church as some kind of a protest, as some kind of a screw you to, like, these lockdown restrictions, and they ended up screwing around and finding out, right? Like they ended up getting themselves sick as a way to own the libs. We just published that study a few weeks back. But it's this kind of idea of, like, of libertarian means I can do whatever I want without consequence, and that is my right as kind of like white Christian citizen.
There definitely is also a race dimension of this too that you really have to underline, which is, I'll give an example. So you remember Strom Thurmond, the long-serving white supremacist senator from South Carolina? So as a young man, he was actually a Democrat, and he was progressive as long as the progressivism was just for white people. And, you know, after Brown v. Board and, you know, the civil rights movement, he changed his tune and he suddenly became a conservative and he became a libertarian. Now, why did he become a libertarian? Well, you know, part of what libertarianism is about is says, well, you know, keep the government out of my life, which is, you know, in this case, it means, well, keep the government from giving any money to people whom I don't like. So, of course, these folks are not opposed to government giving money to folks like them. You know, you might remember during the Tea Party movement, there was like, you know, keep the government out of my Medicare, right? As if it was like something that belonged to me. One thing I worry about, and this is part of this anti-democratic trend that we're starting to see, is you're starting to hear on the far right more and more authoritarian rhetoric. So they're not saying, you know, oh, libertarianism, that was definitely a mistake. You know, what we really need is we need a strong government that's going to take on the liberals and take on the elites and impose our views on everybody else. So, you know, basically the kind of political philosophy is following the money and privilege is what's happening.
That's really helpful to understand. My dilemma, Dr. Gorski, something I struggle with. We have essentially a two-party system, certainly at the national level, right? You can vote for a Republican or a Democrat. And even as we see more and more Republican candidates sort of openly championing this authoritarianism, other aspects of white Christian nationalism, like making it more difficult or at least not easier to vote, these blatant displays, right? If I'm conservative, if I'm so-called pro-life, however you define that, if I stand for these certain principles associated with the Republican Party, I in some sense feel constrained no matter who the candidate is because that's the Republican candidate. Is that a legitimate sort of conundrum, and is there any way to address that?
Boy, I think about this a lot. I'm sure Sam will have thoughts too. One thing I would say is that the Republican Party is not a conservative party, not anymore. It's a radical party. It's not a party that's about preserving American institutions and traditions and values. It's a party that's about burning it all down. And so I think right now what is really important is for folks who do support a pluralistic society, who do support liberal democracy, to band together in defense of it. And that probably is going to mean that, you know, some of the issues that we really care very deeply about, you know, maybe that's pro-life issue. We maybe just have to set those arguments aside for a time, because if we don't, what's going to happen is we're going to have an authoritarian government. And I can tell you, you know, historically how that turns out, that also authoritarianism and corruption go hand in hand, and corruption and poverty go hand in hand. This is not going to turn out well for any of us, including the folks who think they're defending their own best interests here. So, what we need is a kind of a coalition that runs from, you know, I put it this way sometimes, from AOC to Liz Cheney. And those are two very powerful, very charismatic ladies who I doubt they agree about very much in terms of social policy, but they both agree about defending American democracy and the American Constitution. And, you know, hopefully if we succeed in that, we can go back to having some of the arguments that we've had about the size of government or, you know, pro-life versus, you know, pro-choice. But, you know, for now, I think the threat is so grave that we really do need to set aside some of those disagreements for a while.
That's powerful. Dr. Perry, you have anything to add to this sort of binary constraint that we see ourselves in?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, a part of the problem is, I mean, we talk a lot about polarization. Mostly what we mean by that isn't extremes per se. I mean, the Republicans, asymmetrical polarization has happened in the sense that Republicans have moved toward extremes faster than Democrats have by a lot. Democrats are a coalition party. They're far more likely to be made up of moderates and all kinds of diverse groups. I think maybe 55% of the Democratic Party is white. The rest are non-white. There's a large percentage of seculars, large percentage of say, African-American Protestants and Hispanic Catholics and white liberal Protestants. And I think what is driving a lot of, I think, Republican unity is not at all the fact that like everybody has a coherent political theology or understanding of what's going on. I think most Americans don't live in that space. But they understand negative polarization. They understand kind of like animosity or hostility toward the other group. That is actually what most, I think, Republican politicians are campaigning on. So, for example, Oklahoma, where you almost don't need to campaign. I mean, it's so red, but like every ad that I see for like Governor Stitt, who is running for reelection, and every ad that I see isn't about his candidate. It is about associating his candidate with Biden. Every ad is about like, if you vote for this candidate, it's just like voting for Biden. What's the point of that? Well, it's because most Oklahomans don't know anything about what's going on in Oklahoma, but they do know where they stand on Biden. And if most of them don't like Biden, they're going to vote for the other guy. And so I think what we are dealing with is a profound ignorance in the voting populace about like what are the issues on offer, but also heightened polarization that comes from the top down. Where you have a Marjorie Taylor Greene or a Boebert or a Mastriano or a Trump or a DeSantis or a Josh Hawley coming in and comparing their enemies to Satan, right? Like and talking about the Luciferian left. Well, that just makes any kind of democratic choice impossible, right? Because how could you even make a choice there in the situation? So I think, you know, politicians, especially, I don't know how we do this, but except at the ballot box, but politicians need to be held to account to say, you know, hey, we want to be America, not this kind of hyper-polarized, hate-filled, dystopian war zone.
I was recently on a panel conversation with a political scientist who said, you know, she often gets asked by people, well, how do I get someone who's Republican to vote for a Democratic candidate who's going to preserve democracy? And she was just like, you can't. Like, they won't do that. But what you can ask is that they put forth better candidates that will at least protect, you know, the basic processes, democratic processes. So that was a reality check. Let's get practical here as we take all of this information, try to synthesize it. We, you know, the folks who studied this and talk about this, and especially looking back to January 6th, understand the stakes in upcoming elections in our political landscape in general. Literally, democracy itself, being able to vote, being confident that the results of particular elections is what people will hold to without saying it was a lie or demanding, you know, an overturn. All of that is at stake right now. And so for the people listening, on a very, you know, sort of actionable level, what are some things that we could do to, you know, do something little and pedestrian like prevent the fall of democracy? Dr. Gorski, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I guess I have two thoughts. I mean, one is just for any American who cares about democracy, and another is for people of faith. One thing is to kind of get more engaged at the local and state level. You know, maybe the other side is in control of the White House or Washington, D.C., or maybe your state capitol, but maybe they're not in control of your local school board or your local city council or something like that, right? And so folks have to get engaged, and of course they also have to get organized. People sometimes say, well, you know, but like these far right white Christian nationalists, okay, maybe they're 20% of the population, but they're not 50% of the population. It's like, well, you're right about that, but boy, they're a lot better organized than we are. And so we got to get organized as well, you know, which is difficult because we're a more diverse coalition. But I think there really is a very important role for people of faith to play here too, just because, you know, there are plenty of folks, you know, white folks and white churches who, I don't know, it's feel uneasy with how things are going. And they, you know, they somehow feel this just isn't right. You know, that this kind of the violent talk, the hateful rhetoric, And, you know, what some of those folks need is they just need an off ramp. They just need somebody to kind of, you know, point the way back, you know, maybe kind of get into the passenger seat with them and help them steer in the right direction. And, you know, that's not work that can be done, you know, with a survey or a historical study. You know, that has to be, you know, we all live in stories. We live through stories. You gotta, you know, part of the white Christian power of white Christian nationalism is that it is a powerful story for a lot of people that gives them a sense of purpose and meaning and their place and things. And you can't counter that with just a bunch of facts and statistics. As much as Sam and I wish you could, you just can't. You have to counter that with a different narrative. And that's got to be, you know, a narrative that's inclusive, that's pluralistic, that's grounded in love and a love of justice. And, you know, certainly, the Christian stories, you know, the Christian Bible provides plenty of sources, plenty of such stories. And so part of it is just repeating those stories and as an alternative to this false story, this heretical story, this heretical version of Christianity.
That's very helpful. Dr. Perry, would you add anything?
Yeah, I think I think it's going to take courage on the part of pastors and faith leaders to be able to speak out against this. In social psychology, we have this concept that we call pluralistic ignorance, and it is the phenomenon where I incorrectly believe that the majority of people in my group believe something that I don't believe, that I don't share, that I don't want to do. But I believe that everybody else thinks it, and so I kind of go along with it at the time. Oftentimes in experiments is usually like college students who don't want to engage in kind of hookup sex all over the place or illegal drugs, but they believe everybody's doing it, so they kind of go along with it, they get protest. And I think something similar probably goes on within these congregations that you have people who really do look around and say, I don't want this. I don't want Christian nationalism. This isn't what I'm about. I don't want I'm uncomfortable with the way this is going. But it takes some people it takes a critical capacity of people to say, I'm not down for this, guys. I'm not in for this at all. And the power of a pastor, the power of a leader to be able to speak out against it, they're going to get hammered. I mean, just as you see, like anybody on the right who steps up and speaks out and says, yeah, Christian nationalism is not the way to go, they're going to get ganged up on by a lot of the people who says, oh, you're woke. You're a tool of the left. You punch right and you coddle left and you do all these, you do all these things. But it takes a critical capacity of people to say, This is racist. This is backwards. This is anti-democratic. It's un-American and it's un-Christian. But that is a real risk for them. I mean, I'm go to church here in Norman, and I'm friends with a lot of pastors here locally in Norman. And the last 2 years have witnessed a whole lot of sorting on the basis of things like Trump and abortion and race. And if you say anything as a pastor, it signals and people leave. If you said anything about George Floyd, you were woke, and people left. And if you didn't come out hard for Trump, you were a tool of the left, and people left. Or if you didn't come out hard enough for George Floyd, I mean, people said, no, I'm out of here. So people, religious leaders, faithfully Christian leaders, have to know that like this is going to take courage to say like we're not down with this. Here's what it means to be a Christian. Here's what it means to be a patriot. And it isn't Christian nationalism, but that is, we have to encourage them and champion those efforts.
Gentlemen, I have learned so much. I was taking notes. This is going to be extremely helpful for people. And I can imagine folks are going to want more. What I keep saying, these are the beginnings of conversations, not the end all be all. So what are some ways that people can keep up with you and your work, Dr. Gorski?
Well, I guess you can follow us, follow me and Sam on Twitter. Gorski Philip, Prof. Sam Perry. That'd be the main way to keep up. And I don't write as quickly as Sam does, but you know, follow Sam. You know, if you can, it's a hard man to keep up with.
I'm saying absolutely. All these studies you referenced that have come out since the book came out. I'm like, okay, he must need 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night. Dr. Perry, anything else or anything you're working on that you want us to know about?
No, I think this is where our focus is right now. We want to make sure that we're available. So I think, yeah, following us on Twitter, but also, I think Phil and I both want to be as available as we can to speak to a broad audience of people who are interested in this topic. And so we want to make ourselves open to that.
Well, I appreciate you making yourselves available. And I'm going to plug this book one more again, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. You can pick this up on my bookshop page and wherever books are sold. Dr. Perry, Dr. Gorski, thank you for joining us on White Nation Under God.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jamar.
America.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Areopagus Podcast, two clergy of different traditions, Father Andrew Stephen Damick and Michael Landsman, discuss encounters of historic Christianity with other religious traditions. How do we engage with those who believe differently? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.